How many of you have something precious that you have at home? Maybe stored in a box, maybe stored in a closet, maybe stored in a drawer. I know I have several things that I cherish, and we know that God says we're to store our treasures on in heaven, not here on earth. But even so, there's things that we do cherish here. There's things that we have that we love. One of mine is a .22 rifle that my wife's father gave me that he got in Europe. That's 1950-something, and it's just a beautiful wood-grained .22. I have several coins from my great-great-grandfather, old silver dollars that he collected. And so there's just different things like that that are precious to me, that I hold on to. Well, I want to tell you a story about an elderly gentleman. And he was growing old and he was growing feeble, as we all do as we get older. And his family thought, hey, he was a little bit, on the eccentric side because he had these different habits. He had these really, I think you call different collections, as we might say. And he had in his possession a box that really intrigued them. Yet he never opened it when they were around. When he was alone, he would open the box carefully and examine its contents. Then he would carefully put them all back in the box and hide the box someplace secure where he knew nobody would find it. They thought it might be something valuable. And when he wasn't around, of course, the family members searched for it, but never found it. Well, as he grew feebler and frailer and his health began to deteriorate, the family began to speculate about what was in that box. Of course, they all knew that someone would inherit it after death. They thought it might be something valuable, maybe stocks or bonds, or jewels, or even gold. Others thought it might be deeds to property that was also very valuable. They were sure it was valuable because he checked it all the time. He looked at it all the time, or else he wouldn't have taken such good care of it and protected it. They began looking forward to his death, only so they could get their hands on the contents of the box. When the elderly man died, they finally got their wish. And they were all shocked at the contents of the box. Do you ever think God does something on a whim? Do you think that he plans everything out carefully? They began again to look for this box. And you and I, as human beings, can think on our own, there has to be a better way to do this. I mean, have you not thought that? I know I have. I think God's got a plan, but you know what? It wouldn't be simpler just to do this and this way. Then as it unfolds, as we see what God has planned for us comes to life, we realize that God's way is indeed the best. You know, we miss many important things and principles at times in our lives because we fail to stop and ask ourselves, what is the significance for that? Why? Why does he do it that way? What is the significance? Why he did certain things in certain ways? When God gets very specific in his instructions to us, he has a reason for doing so. A good example of this is the building of the temple and the tabernacle that's in the temple. He was very specific and he had reasons for what he wanted done. These things we find in the New Testament are really a forerunner for the things that we call the heavenly temple that is talked about. They are all important, not only to God, but this should be important to us. The Ark of the Covenant was probably the most important part of the tabernacle in the first temple. It represented the presence of God in the nation with Israel. We're not going to turn there, but in Exodus chapter 25, verses 10 through 21, it describes the ark and the mercy seat. And the mercy seat that sat above the Ark of the Covenant symbolized God's throne among his people. It was the center of worship of God by Israel. God showed his presence among his people in the Holy of Holies. And if there was a fire over it at night and a cloud over it in the day, you knew God was there. God was present. So God gave specific instructions for the building of the ark as well as the mercy seat, giving the exact dimensions as well as the material that were going to be used to build it. He was very particular regarding everything used in the worship of him. He left nothing to chance or to be guessed at. He even gave specific instructions on how the ark should be transported. As we know, suspended from two long poles that went through eyelets built into the ark. Let's turn over to 1 Samuel chapter 4 and verse 6. As we begin this afternoon, 1 Samuel chapter 4, beginning in verse 6. This ark was to be moved, right? Was to be moved by his servants, the Levites. 1 Samuel chapter 4 and verse 6. Now when the Philistines heard the noise and of the shout, they said, "What does the sound of this great shout in the camp of the Hebrews mean?" So this is the ark coming in, and the Hebrews all shouted, right? And the Philistines were kind of surprised. They're saying here, what was this about? Then they understood that the ark of the Lord had come into the camp. So they knew about the ark of the Lord, didn't they? They knew about it. It says, so the Philistines were afraid, for they said, "God has come up into the camp." Also interesting. They said, "God has come up into the camp." If we go on, it says, and they said, "Woe to us, for such a thing has never happened before. Woe to us. Who will deliver us from the hands of these mighty gods?" Wait a minute. He just said God, and now he's calling them gods. So you knew he had maybe an understanding of what it was. It came from the Hebrews. It was God. But here he's talking about gods. These are the gods who struck the Egyptians with all the plagues in the wilderness. "Be strong and conduct yourselves like men, you Philistines, that you do not become servants of the Hebrews, as they have been to you. Conduct yourselves like men and fight." So the Philistines fought again, and Israel was defeated, and every man fled to his tent. There was a very great slaughter, and there fell of Israel 30,000 foot soldiers. Also, the ark of God was captured, and two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died. Well, let's keep going in chapter 5 and verse 1. Chapter 5 says, "Then the Philistines took the ark of God and brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod." So what you'll find, I'm not going to continue reading there, you can later on, but what you'll find happening is that God cursed them, right? He cursed them and brought them to severe plagues in the nation. And until they sent the ark back to Israel about 7 months later. And the ark stayed at the house of Abinadab. That's where it was, where his son was to keep watch over it. Now, move to chapter 6. Chapter 6 and verse 7. It says, "Then the anger of the Lord was aroused against Uzzah, and God struck him there for his error, and he died there by the ark of God." So when David sought to bring the ark back to Jerusalem, God realized at that point they didn't have the proper respect for it. They still didn't after all these years, and taught them, I think, a very valuable lesson here. God was so particular. He was so concerned. Now think about this ark, and I'll explain more here as we go on. But concerned that the ark was being back on a cart, and the cart began to tip over, and Uzzah, guess what, puts his hands out to save it. I mean, who wouldn't do that? I think all of us would try to do that, right? But unless we understood what he was trying to tell them and what he was trying to show them. But he reached out to stabilize it, to protect it, and what happened? God struck him dead on the spot. God was upset they didn't follow his instructions, right? He told them how to handle it. He explained what to do with that and transported it in a manner that he specified. They took it lightly, and he paid the cost with his life. I don't know if you know this, but the word ark means box. It means box. It means a chest. It means a coffer. So as we go through the rest of the sermon, I'm going to call the Ark of the Covenant God's box. Okay? Because we started out with the man that was older. He had his box. This is God's box. Okay? This is God's box. And so we're going to find out that in this box that God loves so much, he had things placed. You and I also can look at Moses, right? The ark of Noah kept Noah. Ark, the box, right? Kept Noah. It kept his animals. It kept everything God wanted him to take with him. It protected them, right? That's what it did. In the case of the Ark of the Covenant, we can also see that it was a box used to keep certain things safe for God and us. And we're going to find that out. Again, it formed the base upon which the mercy seat was, representing the very throne of God. Right? The throne of God among his people, and it was placed there. What were the items, again, that were stored in there? Do you know? Maybe you've read that. Maybe it's been a while since you've read that you looked at that. Did you ever wonder why those things were put in there? If you know what those are. Why God put those there? Was it just by chance? Or just something, you know what? Hey, why don't you just throw it in there? Looks like a good thing to keep. Why did he choose these particular items? Because he did it out of love and out of concern for us, his people. Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 34. Hebrews chapter 9. Sorry, verse 3 and 4, not 34. Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 3. It goes on and says, and behind the second veil, the part of the tabernacle which is called the holiest of all, which had the golden censer and the ark of the covenant overlaid on all sides with gold, in which were the golden pot that had the manna, Aaron's rod that budded, and the tablets of the covenant. So inside the holy of holies, right, you have the ark of the covenant, and inside the ark of the covenant, you had the golden pot of manna. You had that Aaron's rod that budded, and he also had the tablets of the covenant. Just three items. And I mean that, when you look at pictures of it, that was a large box, wasn't it? And why only three? We could have put a lot more in there. I mean, I got a lot of stuff I could put in my box, but it's not big enough. In fact, my wife tells me to get rid of all my stuff. But you have to remember, each one of these items that were in the box were vital. Vital to God. And they also should be vital to us, God's people. What did the ark stand for? What did the box, the Ark of the Covenant, what did it stand for? Well, let's look at that. We're going to look at that first before we go into those three items that were inside the Ark of the Covenant. Let's go to Exodus chapter 25. Exodus chapter 25, beginning in verse 21. Exodus 25, verse 21. You shall put the mercy seat on top of the ark, and in the ark you shall put the testimony that I give to you. And there I will meet with you, and I will speak with you from above the mercy seat, from between the two cherubim which are on the ark of the testimony, about everything which I give you in commandment to the children of Israel. So here again we see the Ark of the Covenant also served, again, as the base for the mercy seat, the throne of God among his people. It was the foundation again, the foundation of God's greatness, his love, and his mercy. That was the foundation for this. The items placed in it had to do with God's care, didn't it? God's care, his protection, his love, and his mercy for us, his people. Okay, so let's look at some of the items that are in the Ark of the Covenant. Again, they were chosen because each one had a special, I think, meaning to Israel and to the relationship with God. Each one of these. And each had an impact, really, I think, on Israel's faith and their belief. So let's see what we find out about this. What impacted their belief? What impacted their faith of the children of Israel? And we'll begin with the manna. The manna. Then we'll go to Aaron's rod, and then we'll go to the tablets of the covenant. Why was the manna put in the ark? I mean, surely it wouldn't last, right? Because remember, it said they kept it for a day, it would start stinking and go bad. Or no? Well, I think it was for protection, right? Could be. He was protecting the manna. It could be for self-keeping. Maybe it was a memorial, right? A memorial for the people. Why did it merit such a special position? Manna. Well, let's go to Exodus 16 and verse 4. Exodus chapter 16, verse 4. Exodus 16 and verse 4. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a certain quota every day, that I may test them, whether they will walk in my law or not." So God sent this bread from heaven, right? This manna that was called here. Again, a supernatural substance from God. You know, and I think it could not be attributed to anybody else or anything else. It didn't just show up naturally. This was supernaturally given. Going on to verse 6, it says, "Then Moses and Aaron said to all the children of Israel, 'At evening you shall know that the Lord has brought you out of the land of Egypt. And in the morning you shall see the glory of the Lord, for he hears your complaints against the Lord. But what are we that you complain against us?'" So here we see that it was a sign of God's deliverance through his care, his feeding, and providing for them. It was unlike anything else they'd ever seen, right? In fact, it never ever appeared before this time. And when the dew evaporated, there it was. Verse 15. Well, before that, you know, the one thing that I love about manna that I think about all the time, and I actually hope we get some when the kingdom comes, because it says it's like wafers that taste like honey. And I love wafer. I mean, like, graham crackers, that's kind of a wafer with kind of honey nut, you know, whatever. Anyway, I just thought I'd make that point. Sounds good to me. I'm looking forward to it. Verse 15 says, "When the children of Israel saw it, they said to one another, 'What is it?' For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, 'This is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat. This is the thing which the Lord has commanded. Let every man gather it according to each one's need. One omer for each person. According to the number of persons, let every man take for those who are in his tent.'" Now, we all have different ideas of what we need. And I was telling earlier this morning that when we were at camp, preteen camp, we had to tell the preteen campers that take just enough to eat, and when you're done, you can come get seconds. And yet they still went to their tables with plates heaping, and half of it went into the trash. They didn't listen, did they? Here, how many of us, I mean, in our human nature, how many of us would take one omer for each person, only what we needed? It'd be a hard lesson, wouldn't it? But here, that's what God said. Israel was provided for, right? God gave them this for 40 years, each day of the year, except for the Sabbath. God gave them bread from heaven. Verse 19 says that Moses said, "Let no one leave any of it until morning." So it's, again, very specific, wasn't he? Don't leave it. So you couldn't take more because you were not supposed to leave it. So either you're just going to stuff yourself, right, and feel ill all night, or, you know, it'd go bad. As we continue reading here, it says, "No one leave it till morning. Notwithstanding, they did not heed Moses." You'd almost have to say, really? They didn't heed him? Are you kidding me? Of course not. They never did, right? Or very seldom. And when they did, they had to repent, and he'd come back, and it was just, you know, this vicious cycle. But it says, "But some left apart until morning, and the bread it bred worms and stank. And Moses was angry with them." Now, I could say I wasn't angry with these preteens, but I was upset they didn't listen to us. It's like there's plenty. Don't take more than you need. Well, that's what God's telling us. He's testing, right? He's testing us. That's what this is about. It's a test. It's about providing. It's about doing these things. And are we going to listen to what he's trying to tell us? Only what you need here. So he was angry, again, because they didn't follow the instructions. The manna was fragile. Again, it spoiled if you left it overnight. So what happens? That they had to depend and they had to rely on God, didn't they? Every single day, they had to rely on God. You remember what Christ taught? Give us this day our daily bread. Right? This day, our daily bread. It wasn't give us this week our bread. Give us, you know, these couple. No, it's this day. You know, that's the one thing I learned when we were in Africa. Those people lived every day for their meal. They lived for their daily bread. And that was very interesting to watch. Very interesting to see. But Christ taught that. There was something in it that built faith, right? It built faith as they were provided for enough each day. And so there was no chance for them to be what? Self-sufficient, was there? Couldn't rely on themselves because it wouldn't last. One day. Let's go on here to verse 22. And so it was on the sixth day that they gathered twice as much bread, two omers for each one. And all the rulers of the congregation came and told Moses. Then he said to them, this is what the Lord has said. Tomorrow is a Sabbath rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake today, and boil what you will boil, and lay up for yourselves all that remains to be kept until morning. So they laid up till morning, as Moses commanded, and it did not stink, nor were there any worms in it. So we look at this. This is a miracle, isn't it? Now I mentioned that manna was placed in the Ark of the Covenant. Well, God could make it last forever, right? It's God. So here he's doing it for 2 days, right? Friday, you gather enough for Friday and Saturday, and it lasts. You can keep it overnight, and it won't stink. So this is what he's telling us. It's a miracle. And this really, to me, tells us and tells them how important the Sabbath was to God, right? To not gather on the Sabbath. He changed the nature of it to last longer. And one day of the week, again, one day every week for 40 years. Pretty amazing what God is. You can't say God doesn't love us, that God didn't want to care for us. Let's go on to verse 27. It says, now it happened that some of the people went out on the seventh day to gather it. Again, really? Doesn't surprise me. Anybody here? But they found none. And the Lord said to Moses, how long do you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? See, for the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore, he gives you on the sixth day bread for 2 days. Let every man remain in his place. Let no man go out of his place on the seventh day. So the people rested on the seventh day. But still, it's, you know, how hard is it to follow directions? Well, for human beings, it's really hard. I include myself in that. It's hard sometimes to follow, to do what we're told, because it's not what we want. It's easier to do it our way, at least we think. And in the end, we find out it's not as easy. But for those who still weren't convinced, you know, here when they went out, none fell on the Sabbath. God said it wouldn't. So if they didn't believe and depend on God and his goodness to give them it twice as much on Friday, then what happened? They fasted. They didn't have any for Sabbath. God provided. I think that's the important thing we know. But they had to do their part as well. They had to listen to what he was telling them. Verse 31, it says, and the house of Israel called its name manna. And it was like the white coriander seed, and the taste of it was like wafers made with honey. Looking forward to dinner. So you look at this manna. It was the perfect, nutritious food. Perfect. For everyone. It was delicious to the taste. You know, there's a lot of food allergies these days. And I guarantee you, this didn't affect anyone. It was healthy for everyone, in every way, in every aspect. They didn't need anything else. But God was concerned they had something that was not only flavorful, but delicious, but also nutritious. Let's go on to verse 32. Verse 32 says, Moses said, "This is the thing which the Lord has commanded. Fill an omer with it to be kept for your generations." Okay, so we're getting down to the time now when they're going to put it in the Ark of the Covenant. "That they may see the bread which I fed you in the wilderness when I brought you out of the land of Egypt." And Moses said to Aaron, "Take a pot and put an omer of manna in it and lay it up before the Lord to be kept for your generations. As the Lord commanded Moses, so Aaron laid up before the testimony to be kept." So in order to remember God's provision, right, what he had given them in care, they were able to save it. They put it in the Ark of the Covenant. And it is an important reminder to them of what God has done. Verse 35, it says, "And all the children of Israel ate manna 40 years until they came into the inhabited land. They ate manna until they came to the border of the land of Canaan." Again, that's a long time to eat one thing. You know the story. They weren't happy with it, were they? They had to have meat until it was coming out their nostrils, right? Here you had something that God gave them, provided for them, and it was more healthy than anything you could ever had. They would need nothing else, and yet they craved meat. He gave them everything that was necessary, everything that they needed. Again, caring for them, feeding them. Well, let's look at another verse here in Nehemiah chapter 9. Nehemiah, again, just a little bit more about the manna, and then we'll move on. Nehemiah chapter 9, verse 20. Nehemiah chapter 9, verse 20 says, "You also gave your good spirit to instruct them, and did not withhold your manna from their mouth, and gave them water for their thirst. 40 years you sustained them in the wilderness. They lacked nothing. Their clothes did not wear out, and their feet did not swell." And God supernaturally took care of them for 40 years. Anybody here have 40-year-old shoes you're still wearing? No? Me neither. Some are close, but I can't fit in them anymore. But we don't. The manna symbolized, again, God's care for them, God's respect for them. He gave them everything that was necessary, everything that was beneficial. And we think about our lives now. Does he not do the same for us? He does. He provides. We don't have to worry about all these things. I mean, even their clothes and their shoes. Let's turn to the New Testament. Let's go to John chapter 31. John chapter 31. Sorry, John chapter 6. Man, I'm dyslexic. Verse 31. John chapter 6, verse 31. Again, a little bit more about the manna. John chapter 6, verse 31. "Our fathers ate the manna in the desert. As it is written, he gave them bread from heaven to eat." So again, coming from God to provide for them. Verse 33 says, "For the bread of God is he who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world." So here we're talking about now the bread from heaven, Jesus Christ, that came here for us to give us what we need, right? Dropping down to verse 47. "Most assuredly I say to you, he who believes in me has everlasting life. I am the bread of life. Your fathers ate the manna in the wilderness and are dead. This is the bread which comes down from heaven, that one may eat of it and not die." So every time Israel saw or had a thought about the manna, they were reminded of God's grace. Right? They were reminded of God's care, his providing for their needs, him getting through the desert, and for the feeding them both physically and spiritually. That's what it reminded them of. We need to learn the same lesson. Right? The manna should remind us of how much God truly cares for us in providing us in all of our needs. Well, let's move on, finally, to the second item that was in that box, God's box, and that was Aaron's rod that budded. It was also, again, a part of the Ark of the Covenant. The rod was very special, as we'll see as we go through this. And we find in Numbers that it actually budded, this rod of Aaron. It was done to show where God's work was being done, and about people not rebelling against him. According to, if you look at various commentaries, biblical commentaries, and just even commentaries, the rod was, of course, various things. You can look it up, and it's Aaron's rod, and it's Moses' rod, and it's the rod of the Eternal. All these things can be found, the same rod, all the same rod. And the rod was used by Aaron to do some of the bidding, as we know. Let's go to Exodus chapter 4 and verse 2. Exodus chapter 4 and verse 2. Exodus chapter 4 and verse 2. Here it says, "So the Lord said to him, 'What is that in your hand?' And he said, 'A rod.' And he said, 'Cast it on the ground.' So he cast it on the ground and it became a serpent. And Moses fled from it. Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Reach out your hand and take it by the tail.' And he reached out of his hand and caught it, and it became a rod in his hand. God told Moses, 'With this rod you shall do signs.'" God told him that. If we look down at verse 20 here of Exodus 4, it says, "Then Moses took his wife and his sons and set them on a donkey, and he returned to the land of Egypt, and Moses took the rod of God in his hand." So here we now we have the rod of God in his hand. Chapter 7. Just up a few pages, chapter 7 and verse 9. Exodus chapter 7 and verse 9. You know, and here we saw it was the rod of God because it was all the miracles God had done with it. That's why it was called the rod of God at that time. So here, Exodus 7 and verse 9, "When Pharaoh speaks to you, saying, 'Show a miracle for yourselves,' then you shall say to Aaron, 'Take your rod and cast it before Pharaoh, and let it become a serpent.' So Moses and Aaron went to the Pharaoh, or into Pharaoh, and they did so, just as the Lord commanded. And Aaron cast his rod before Pharaoh and before the servants, and it became a serpent. But Pharaoh also called the wise men and the sorcerers. So the magicians of Egypt, they also did in like manner with their enchantments. For every man threw down his rod, and they became serpents. But Aaron's rod swallowed up their rods. And Pharaoh's heart grew hard and did not heed them as the Lord had said." Again, notice here it's called Aaron's rod, which he used in Pharaoh's court. I'm not going to go through all the plagues. That would take some time. But you can read those for yourself if you want, Exodus chapter 8, 9, and 10, and go through all of those and see how that rod was used in different aspects for Israel. But let's now go to Exodus chapter 14. Exodus 14, and verse 16. Exodus 14 and verse 16. It says, "But lift up your rod and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it." So here we have, right, Moses departing the Red Sea. "And the children of Israel shall go out on the dry ground through the midst of the sea." So you'll notice over and over again as we go through this that the rod is used to perform really miracles for the deliverance and the protection of Israel. That's what it was for. Up a few more chapters to Exodus 17. Exodus chapter 17 and verse 5 and 6. Exodus chapter 17 verses 5 and 6. "And the Lord said to Moses, Go on before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel. Also take in your hand your rod with which you struck the river and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock in Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and the water will come out of it that the people might drink or may drink. So this was in the sight of all the elders of Israel, right? Moses' rod brings forth water from a rock. Verse 9, it says, and Moses said to Joshua, choose us some men and go out and fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand. So we know the aspects here is when Moses held up the rod above his head, Israel won. And when he dropped it down, went below, they lost. So we here have the rod of Moses doing this, of course, God's power through God, but it was for the benefit of the people. It was for them to see what was going on, what God wanted them to see. Well, now let's come to the passage where we find it budding. Let's go to Numbers chapter 17. Again, you know here the story probably that there was a rebellion. Imagine that. A rebellion of God's people against God's leadership, against Moses, against Aaron. And God had taken care of it, I think, in a most dramatic way. I mean, the way he's going to do this here. Because they were accusing Moses and Aaron, right, of killing part of God's people. And even though the people were killed, it wasn't because of Moses. It wasn't because of Moses and Aaron. It was because of the rebellion against God. That's why. But here in Numbers chapter 17 and verse 1. Numbers 17 and verse 1. It says, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel and get from them a rod from each father's house. All their leaders, according to the father's houses, 12 rods. Write each man's name on his rod, and you shall write Aaron's name on the rod of Levi. For there shall be one rod for the head of each father's house. Then you shall place him in the tabernacle of the meeting before the testimony where I meet with you. And it shall be that the rod of the man whom I choose will blossom. Thus I will rid myself of the complaints of the children of Israel, which they make against you. So he's like, okay, we'll solve this problem. Go ahead and get your rods. Let's solve this once and for all. Going down to verse 7, it says, and Moses placed the rods before the Lord in a tabernacle of witness. Now it came to pass the next day that Moses went into the tabernacle of witness, and behold, the rod of Aaron of the house of Levi had sprouted and put forth buds and produced blossoms and yielded ripe almonds. Pretty amazing for nothing being planted, huh? Nothing to get to it. God provided that. Then Moses brought out all the rods from before the Lord to all the children of Israel, and they looked, and each man took his rod. Aaron's rod had budded and produced almonds, showing where God was working, showing he was working with Aaron and Moses and the rod that they were using. Going on to verse 10, it says, and the Lord said to Moses, bring Aaron's rod back before the testimony, to be kept as a sign against the rebels. Right? So God put it in that box, his box, to declare what? To show the rebellion. To remind them of the rebellion. Rebels, that you may put their complaints away from me, lest they die. Thus did Moses, just as the Lord commanded him, so he did. So he put it in there to remind them against the rebellion. You don't rebel against God. And as a sign, this was where the Eternal is working. That's what he wanted to know. This is where I'm working with these men. Okay, what about the third item in the Ark? The two tablets of the covenant and the Ten Commandments, I guess we could say. Let's go back to Exodus 25. Exodus chapter 25. In verse 16, it's a real short one here. I could have just done it without you turning because we're going to Deuteronomy chapter 10 next. But here in Exodus chapter 25 and verse 16, it says, you shall put into the ark the testimony which I will give you. Right? So this is a command. They're supposed to put this in the ark of the testimony. And then we go to Deuteronomy chapter 10. Deuteronomy chapter 10 and verse 3. Deuteronomy chapter 10 and verse 3. So I made an ark of acacia wood, hewed two tablets of stone like the first. Remember the first ones he threw down and broke. And went to the mountain, having the two tablets in my hand. And he wrote on the tablets according to the first writing, the Ten Commandments, which the Lord has spoken to you in the mountain from the midst of the fire in the day of the assembly. And the Lord gave them to me. Then I turned and came down from the mountain and put the tablets in the ark, which I had made, and there they are, just as the Lord commanded me. We know that the law of God is the basis for life. Right? It's what we base our lives on, at least I hope we do. The Ten Commandments. And it's central to the covenant relationship that you and I have with God. Central. The law sums up how to love God. But it also sums up how we're to love mankind. Love our brother. Right? That's what it tells us. It gives instructions how to live a successful life. Well, turn a few chapters back to Deuteronomy chapter 6. Deuteronomy chapter 6 and verse 5. Again, you probably all know this scripture. Remember it as when I read it and you read it. Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 5, it says, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. And these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and at your gates." So again, that to me tells me they're central, right? They're a central part of our lives. They're not to be ever out of sight. They're there with us always. Verse 17, it goes on to say, "And you shall diligently keep the commandments of the Lord your God, his testimonies and his statutes which he has commanded you, and you shall do what is right and good in the sight of the Lord, that it may be well with you, and that you may go in and possess the good land which the Lord swore to your fathers, to cast out all of your enemies before you, as the Lord has spoken. When your son asks you in time to come, saying, 'What is the meaning of the testimonies, the statutes, and the judgments which the Lord our God has commanded you?' Then you shall say to your son or your daughter, 'We were slaves of Pharaoh in Egypt, and the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand, and the Lord showed us signs and wonders before your eyes, before our eyes, great and severe against Egypt, Pharaoh and all his household. And that he brought us out of there, that he might bring us in to give us the land of which he swore to our fathers. And the Lord commanded us to observe all these statutes, to fear the Lord our God, for our good always, that he might preserve us alive as it is this day. Then it will be righteousness for us, for we are careful to observe all these commandments before our Lord our God, and he has commanded us." So this, I look at as a responsibility of us parents, right? We have a responsibility, all of us, to our kids, our children, our grandkids. These are explained to each generation as they come up, as they come along. Having them in the Ark of the Covenant would remind the people that they were the very basis, right? The basis for the covenant relationship with God, what we had to do. The law of God represents, again, the covenant of God. Let's turn over to Judges chapter 2. Judges chapter 2. In verse 1. Judges chapter 2 and verse 1. It says, "Then the angel of the Lord came up from Gilgal to Bochim and said, 'I led you up from Egypt and brought you out of the land which I swore to your fathers. And I said, I will never break my covenant with you.'" Now, did you get that? He will never break his covenant with us. Never. Even though they broke it, right? Israel, even though they broke it, he is still working to reconcile them back to him and into relationship once again. We are the same. You and I are exactly the same as Israel. He wants that covenant relationship with us. God will never be the one to leave that relationship. We can leave it, be chastised, repent, and come back, and he will once again have that relationship with him. People have done it. Or we can leave it and stay gone, forfeiting the covenant, the relationship, that, and pay that penalty. But God will never leave or forsake us. I'm sure all of you have heard that before in sermons. We know that. Let's go to Ezekiel chapter 16. Ezekiel chapter 16. You know, with this world the way it's going and what's happening all around us, we know that there's issues, there's problems. We all have things that we worry about. We all have things, but we don't have to, do we? Even though we will. God didn't give us a spirit of fear. He gave us a spirit of power. Power, his power. We have that within us. And we need to remember these things, that God will never leave us or forsake us. We can keep on, we can put that in our caps and keep it. It's there. Ezekiel 16 and verse 60. It says, "Nevertheless, I will remember my covenant with you in the days of your youth, and I will establish an everlasting covenant with you. Then you will remember your ways and be ashamed when you receive your older and your younger sisters, for I will give them to you for daughters, but not because of the covenant, my covenant with you." So eventually his people remembered their ways, right? They remembered them and they were ashamed. Ashamed of the way they had been going. You know, there is a lot in that category in this stage in the church. There is. Just as I'm sure there were in every age of God's relationship with his people. We're all at all different levels, aren't we? We're all different places in our relationship with God. It's not a bad thing. That's just what it is. But this is so true even now. Verse 62, it says, "And I will establish my covenant with you. Then you shall know that I am the Lord." So they will again know the significance, right, of his covenant, what that covenant means, and why the things were in the Ark of the Covenant. Why were they there, as we just went through? It's through the covenant of God that he shows us his blessings, that he shows us his protection, the correction at times when needed, that we are his people. And he is our God. He has chosen a people who will not reject. Right? That's his ultimate goal, a people who will not reject, even though they have gone astray. And we all have done that. His plan includes a stage of waking them up, right, bringing them back into relationship with him. Jeremiah chapter 31. Jeremiah chapter 31. Begin in verse 31. Jeremiah 31, verse 31. "Behold, the days are coming, says the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand and led them out of the land of Egypt, my covenant which they broke, though I was a husband to them, says the Lord. But this is a covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, says the Lord. I will put my law in their minds and write it in their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people." This is the covenant that God has made with his people. Same basis that we've gone through, right? Same with the same people. He will write his laws in terms of the covenant, in terms of what his laws are, his statutes, his judgments, into our minds and into our hearts. And as we keep the covenant, God will bless us and he'll preserve us. Let's turn one chapter ahead as we close here. Jeremiah chapter 32. Jeremiah chapter 32 and verse 40. Jeremiah chapter 32 and verse 40. And I will make an everlasting covenant with them, that I will not turn away from doing them good, but I will put my fear in their hearts so that they will not depart from me. God does not want us to leave. God doesn't want us to depart. God doesn't want us to go anywhere else but to his kingdom, to his family, to be with him. And God's covenant with his people is an everlasting covenant. Again, he will never break it. He will not. And finally, hopefully, we will learn not to depart from it, not to leave it. Well, let's go back to our story that we started with in the beginning. The elderly gentleman died. The corpse in the box was located and it was opened at the reading of the will. When it was opened, everyone was shocked and disappointed. In the box were the following items: his wife's wedding ring, a lock of hair, baby pictures of each of his five children, a letter his wife had written him telling how much she missed and needed him when he was working away from home, their marriage license, and a few other mementos. Nothing valuable, except to him, right? Nothing valuable to anybody else when they looked at it, but it was to him. It reminded him of his life, of his wife, of his family. Those were what was important to him. At first glance, those items in the Ark of the Covenant, when we look at that, might seem insignificant, might seem like, well, what's the big deal? Why are those things in there? But they're extremely important and valuable to God. And they should be to us too, as a reminder of his power, of his guidance in our lives. I hope we can consider the Ark and the things that were in it, that we realize that it's a very basis for all of God's dealings with us. Everything he has done with us, everything he's teaching us, just as he did for ancient Israel, he will feed and nourish us with the perfect nutrition, with supernatural food and spiritual food. He will always supply our needs daily. He will rescue and protect us supernaturally with miracles, if necessary. But above all, he will never leave us or forsake us. He will always be there for us.